This is not true. Everyone needs somebody who can be supportive and a guide. You'll find the answers you're looking for and the tools to both find answers and offer solutions on the Dr. Melanie Show. Now, here's your host, Dr. Melanie Barton.
Welcome to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. I hope you had an enjoyable holiday and that you're not feeling too much guilt over what you ate. You know, our society is so focused on food. It seems like every other TV commercial is about weight loss or some medication to counteract the effects of weight gain. Many people are obsessed with food, either overeating or starving themselves even to the point of death. For those of you who are old enough, you may remember a popular singer, Karen Carpenter. She died in the 1970s of cardiac arrest after she had gone through successful treatment for her anorexia. So even though you've been successful with it, sometimes you can still have major complications and death. Well, today we're talking about eating disorders. It's estimated between 5 and 10 million women in the United States and a million men have an eating disorder. Our sponsor for the first half of this show today is Timberline Knowles Treatment Center for Eating Disorders in Lamont, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. We're privileged to have as my first guest Dr. Kimberly Dennis, the medical director of the facility. She's a board-certified psychiatrist who specializes in treating addictions, eating disorders, and co-occurring disorders. And my second guest will be a woman nicknamed Mel, who's in recovery for an eating disorder. But first, let's get to know Dr. Kim. Welcome, Dr. Kim.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, I'm glad that we could do this because this is a timely topic for this time of year. Have you found that as a psychiatrist, your patients nowadays are more open to admitting and talking about their addictions?
To a greater extent today than, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly 15 years ago. I think that has a lot to do with some decrease in stigma around having an addiction spectrum disorder, whether that plays out with substances, alcohol, food, other things. And also, we've learned a lot about the neurobiology behind addiction, and some of the brain science that helps us understand that it actually is a real disease and that people are powerless over having the disease.
Mm-hmm. And in my 30 years of being a therapist, it was long ago where everybody said, oh, if the person has an eating disorder, they have an issue with their parent. That's something they were lacking with their parent.
Right.
So I don't know if that's still one of the factors that you look for in diagnosing something, if there is an issue with a parent?
Well, many times there is. I think, you know, back in the day it was in vogue to blame the mother.
Yes.
We try to stay out of the blame game because that's not useful to any party involved.
Correct.
You know, many times these are multifactorial diseases. So there are emotional factors, there are life experience factors, spiritual factors, and physical factors that go into the development of an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So we absolutely look at family systems. We look at intergenerational issues.
Mm-hmm.
We believe eating disorders are family diseases and that everyone in the family is affected by the disease.
Oh, definitely. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, so we absolutely address the family, but we do it in a way that's constructive to the family member's recovery as well as the identified patient's recovery.
That's good, because I know so many of the moms that I've dealt with who had a child, male or female, that had an eating disorder, the guilt the parent felt was just so enormous that it kept them captive. They couldn't get out of, I'm just so guilty, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a tragic thing to be a parent watching your kid die of an eating disorder and not knowing what to do, not really being able to do anything about it on your own.
Mm-hmm. And so often people don't understand it's a medical and a mental health issue. It's not just one or the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's a really important piece of education that we need to continue doing as a field, both for lay people, for parents, for family members, and for patients, and for insurance companies, for that matter.
I was just going to say that, yes, because I wrote an article on the Social Worker Online Journal about four families that say if your child or some family member is going in for treatment, remember to get pre-authorization for both the mental health and the medical component.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole nother... I think that's probably a whole other show we could do just on how to navigate the insurance benefit system as a parent of somebody with an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Very complicated.
I think that's a really good topic for one of the future shows that we're going to do. So we'll put that in our hat and remember that. So that's very good. Thanks for thinking of that.
No problem.
So this field of addiction, it's a hot topic in many places, but for you, what got your interest to go into this area of expertise?
Several different things, actually. When I was, I began my own personal recovery in medical school when I was at the time in medical school when you need to decide what specialty to go into. And I was deciding between psychiatry and one of the surgical specialties. And I ended up deciding psychiatry. And then later in my psychiatry residency, I had the opportunity to work with Daniel LaGrange, who's a researcher who does a lot with the Maudsley method of family therapy for eating disorders. And I just fell in love with the patient population and really love the work and still do. And there's a addiction psychiatrist in recovery who became a mentor of mine, who really supported me in pursuing work with people who have addictions and eating disorders.
Can you explain what the method is that you described? Because I'm not familiar with the method.
The Maudsley method?
Yes.
It is a specific form of manualized treatment that works on an outpatient basis for intact families. And it basically consists of three phases. The first phase is to empower the parents to do the refeeding of their child. The second phase is to gradually hand the feeding process back over to the adolescent. And then the third phase is to work on family dynamics and developmental issues for the identified patient. It's a research-backed method, but it doesn't work for many of the patients that we see here at Timberline Knowles who have a lot of pathology in their families, who have split families, who have parents who aren't really available to take on the role of refeeding their child.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the methods that works for a certain type of patient.
Okay. And how do you spell that method if somebody wanted to research it?
It's M-A-U-D-L-S-E-Y. Oh, no, S-L-E-Y. Sorry.
Okay. All right. That way, if people want to look it up and find out about it, they can. That's helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
In your biography, you talk about your own journey, and you mentioned that, you know, in medical school, you made some choices. So was your own journey prior to medical school that you figured out you had a problem and worked on it?
I would say that I knew I had a problem when I got to college. And
okay.
It took me the next 6 or 7 years to hit bottom with that.
Mm.
And I tried, you know, to some extent to get some help unsuccessfully.
Okay.
When I was in college and then to some extent when I was in medical school as well. And in part in college, that was because there weren't a whole lot of resources at the University of Chicago in the student health department as far as people with expertise in eating disorders.
Ah, and college is one of the main places that eating disorders really show up.
Yeah. And most college campuses have student health counseling for available for 4 to 6 sessions, and then the benefit ends. And when somebody has a severe and life-threatening eating disorder, it's going to take more than 6 outpatient therapy sessions to affect recovery.
Definitely. So you were successful in getting treatment, getting it turned around.
Eventually.
Okay.
In the end, I was, I believe God put a therapist in my path who did understand co-occurring eating disorders and addiction, and really led me to the help that I needed to be able to stay alive and then be able to thrive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, if you're okay answering this, did it require inpatient treatment for you to get past that crisis?
Well, inpatient treatment was absolutely recommended on more than one occasion, and I absolutely refused it on more than one occasion.
Okay.
It was an ongoing battle with my therapist,
uh-huh.
who couldn't seem to quite understand that I was a medical student and that I couldn't do such a thing.
Yeah, that makes it kind of difficult. Yeah, you can't really explain to your professors, I need to take time off. So,
I actually did take a leave of absence from medical school between my third year and fourth year. And when I talked to my dean of students about it, I said, I want to take this leave of absence so I could do research, which I did. I did a part-time job in a thyroid lab and actually accomplished some good research that year. But I knew that I needed to take time off of the insane schedule of medical school to get help or else I would die.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that you had that self-awareness to do that, because a lot of people are so near death by the time they get into treatment that people have to take over.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for you, it's really good that you personally understand how hard it is for somebody to come into an inpatient treatment facility, let alone all the defenses you've got, but all of the logistics of stopping your life outside of the treatment center to come in.
Yeah, I have so much respect for all the women that come to TK, and I understand the courage that it takes to set foot on a place, on a residential treatment center campus, let alone stay here for a month or 2 months or 6 months.
Oh, wow. And is it just females on this campus?
Yeah, we are all women. We have an adolescent lodge and then 3 adult lodges.
Okay. And what's the resident population? How many? What's your capacity?
122 right now.
Okay.
So.
And do you find at the holiday season that your census is higher, lower, people don't come in? What happens at holiday time?
Typically, wait lists. We've had a wait list for a couple of years now, and typically the wait list will decrease around the holiday season. This year, for some reason, we haven't really experienced that. So we've remained full for the holiday. It takes a fair amount of intervention on a regular basis around the holiday times to support people in staying for the treatment duration that they need.
Yes.
So many people around the holiday times will want to abruptly leave treatment, leave to a discharge plan that is insufficient to really support their ongoing recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when they have, when they have the support of other women in recovery on the lodges, their peers, their therapists, their doctors here, the family therapists and family support, many times they're willing to stick it out and stay in treatment over a very difficult time of year.
Mm-hmm. And that also includes...
We also have people who are very grateful to be in treatment over the holidays, because holidays have been such a horrendous time of year for them in their diseases at home.
Yes, and it also includes having the insurance company back you up that the person can stay as well.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to, at this point in time, take a break, and when we come back, we're going to do an interview with Mel. So let's go to a break.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if you could get the information that you've always needed from a good friend? If you don't know her already, you'll want to meet Janet Zapala. Janet is an accomplished radio and television personality who now brings her experience and a wealth of guests to VoiceAmerica.com. We'll feature discussions about food and drink, nutrition, lifestyles, and fitness, just to name a few. We'll talk about current events and what you want to hear about, too. The show is called Food for Thought. Tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Are you living your vital life? One that is showcasing you at your full potential? There are many issues that stand in the way of most people achieving their full potential. We will discuss these issues and how to overcome them each week on The Vital Life, Awakening Your Full Potential, with host Dr. Carolyn Coker Ross. Living the vital life often requires that we trust our own intuitive voice and that we view illness or life challenges as calls to action to reconnect with the deeper urges of our spirit or soul. Tune in Fridays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Health and Wellness.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
You're listening to The Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. Today's show is about eating disorders. Our sponsor is Timberline Knowles Treatment Center in Lamont, Illinois, and that is for females. The number to reach them is 1-877-706-5922, or you can go to timberlineknowles.com. We're going to talk to the medical director, Dr. Kim, again after the next break. But right now, we are privileged to talk to a woman who's in recovery named Mel. Welcome, Mel.
Hey, thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that you would do this on your break from work. So thank you for doing that.
Absolutely.
So you have...
talking about.
Well, I'm glad, because talking about it and sharing our stories with other people can really help somebody who's right on the edge of, but I don't know that it could work. So
absolutely.
I'm glad you're willing. So what kind of eating disorder have you been dealing with?
Well, like many people, my eating disorder looked very different at different periods of my life. I had gone through pretty severe stretches of anorexia and bulimia, as well as binge eating. And by the time I made it to treatment, I'd say I was in a bulimic cycle, but also suffering from really pervasive anorexic thinking in a lot of different areas of my life. I think I was pretty much starving in every respect, you know, socially, spiritually. I didn't know how to nourish myself really in any of the ways that I know now that I need to.
Mm-hmm. And were you a person that did the purging through the vomiting or laxatives or both?
I experimented with that. The thing that, you know, a quote unquote worked best for me was, the purging through exercise.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. You know, it would be periods of binging followed by exercising basically most of the day, if not all day long. Mm-hmm. And then fasting for some period of time.
Mm-hmm. And did you have specific foods that when you did eat, you allowed yourself to have?
Well, yeah. I mean, normally if I was sticking to my very sort of rigid plan, it would be, you know, very safe foods, I guess you might say. Vegetables, like carbohydrates were sort of on my no list. So if I were to have something that was, that I had told myself wasn't okay, that's sort of what would lead to the binge. But there were certain really simple, low-fat, low-calorie foods that that I did permit myself to have some of. Not enough, nearly.
But. I had one person I worked with that she would wake up in the middle of the night and she would eat frozen concentrated orange juice out of a can and then would feel guilty about the calories and then, you know, couldn't go back to sleep because the thought in her head was, you know, I've overeaten. So it's certain people have certain things that, that are their okay foods and some are not. So.
Absolutely. And most things were on my not okay list. Which, you know, just leads to a lot of misery, a lot of hunger, a lot of desperation.
And for many people, it's the black or white thinking. If you're doing well, okay, you can continue. But if you mess up a little bit, then it's on to the binge.
Right. Right. And that's something I've really had to work on in recovery is sort of learning that my abstinence is oftentimes about being in the gray. I simply cannot follow a meal plan perfectly. I can't do anything perfectly. Mm-hmm. So to give myself permission to be a human being in that respect and not know and make mistakes and have things get a little messy has been, learning how to do that has been a lifesaver.
And for many people with an eating disorder, they have a co-occurring kind of problem, whether it's depression or anxiety or some other thing. And then you try to take the medication to treat that, which is going to affect the weight issue. And then they get so distraught over the gain of weight from the antidepressant, then they throw that away and then they're more depressed and then it's just worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, I know that that's something other people deal with. Honestly, you know, when I was in my eating disorder, I wasn't really willing to receive help for anything that was going on with me. You know, I was just, my whole way of life was about pushing people away and being in isolation. So the idea of really being honest, truly honest about anything was terrifying to me. I didn't have any sort of useful relationships with a therapist who might try to prescribe me something like that.
Well, my experience has been that a number of the women that came to me with an eating disorder, they didn't come because of the eating disorder. They came for some other reason or were sent. But a number of them, their eating disorder behavior began when a relationship ended. And I don't know if that was true for you.
You know, I'm not sure when my eating disorder began. I remember having very, very distorted body image as far back as I can remember. I mean, and then it, you know, sort of grew slowly over time. And, you know, what ended up getting me to the point where I was willing to get treatment, I guess in some ways it was the loss of a relationship because my brother died and addiction runs in my family and my brother overdosed and you know my take on it is sort of that I was in so much pain around this and had so few tools to deal with my emotional reality that I just started deteriorating even more and more rapidly. And my experience is that ED behaviors only work, eating disorder behaviors only work for some limited amount of time, you know, and I'm grateful mine stopped working as I started using them more and more often, and at some point they stopped giving me that sense of control and safety, so, you know, I knew I needed a different option, or I needed to, in my head, you know, I needed to throw in the towel. It was like live differently or commit suicide, because the way I was living was just void of meaning and joy and satisfaction.
Well, I know many have told me that when they did the purging, it felt like, you know, okay, everything's out. It's a clean slate. I can start over now. Was that true for you too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just, it's sort of breathtaking the way I would act out. You know, I would say I would, you know, binge exercise all day and go to bed that night thinking, okay, you know, that's the last time that will ever happen. And I believed it. I really, really, really did. You know, and I might even wake up the next morning and think, today will be different. And
yes,
every part of me wanted that to be true. It's, you know, like Dr. Kim said, I truly believe I was utterly powerless, because if it had been about just wanting it, I could have changed, and that it never happened like that for me. I needed help outside of myself. All the best intentions in the world just wouldn't do it.
So was there a crisis that got you into treatment?
Yeah, you know, I think that experience that I'm describing with my brother, you know, was really the thing that pushed me to use those behaviors more and more and more. And, you know, my experience with them is that they can, acting out with food or with whatever sort of destructive behavior will suppress the feelings to a certain point. But for me, there was a limit to that. The feelings just kept building up, and I had this immense store of grief about this brother that I had suddenly lost, and it just, the behaviors couldn't suppress it anymore. So if anything, they just made me feel worse, because I was feeling so much shame about the way I was living and the way I was treating my body, and I was afraid of gaining weight, and, you know, it just spiraled into this desperation, where I was like, this just doesn't work anymore, you know? And it could have, I mean, in my view, it could have led to giving up on life. But, you know, after, I'm so grateful that I apparently had some small, tiny seed of self-love that said, you know, maybe you deserve more, and maybe there is something more. So, you know, I ended up calling my parents and asking for help, just saying, I will always remember telling them I can't take care of myself anymore. Just that simple.
So what do you think got you to that bottom? Do you think there was any event or person or action, something that you finally said, okay, I give up?
I think what got me to the bottom was just experiencing immense amounts of pain, you know, and it's sort of a terrible thing that's what it takes for so many people. And I see that, you know, in my life today, which involves supporting other recovering people, you know, that's what it takes, is just having so much pain that I finally realize, you know, like, my way doesn't work. But I really do think, when I think about the loss of my brother, and how, when I think about, like, how can I understand this? How can I accept it? Sometimes I do think, well, it's interesting that this is part of what got me to the point where I was in so much pain that I was willing to take in help. I do believe that had a lot to do with it. I don't know what my path would have looked like if I hadn't been through that major trauma.
And that was a double trauma for your parents, to lose your brother, and then if they came to the awareness that, oh my goodness, we could lose our daughter too.
Absolutely. And, you know, I remember my mom saying that to me, like, you know, we can't lose another child. And I'm grateful that awful, awful event sort of woke up various members of my family in different ways to say, hey, something is going on in our family system. And, you know, not everyone has been always willing to look at that and work on it, but there's been sort of growing awareness because of this awful thing.
Mm-hmm. So did they get you the help that you needed? Did they know what to do or where to go?
Yes. Incredibly, you know, they ended up putting me exactly where I needed to be. My mother had some family friends that she talked with, and I did have a the daughter of one of her good friends had been to a residential center, and so she was able to give my mother some information about that. And in this instance, you know, my parents stepped up beautifully for me, and they really took care of me. They sent me off, and you know, it's something I will always be immensely grateful for. I think I absolutely, at that point, needed to be inpatient, and was absolutely terrified to go. I mean, I just tortured myself trying to make that decision because it felt like I was going to prison or something. I was terrified. I was just absolutely terrified, but it was, you know, it was just the best thing in the world for me at that moment.
Well, giving up that sense of control, really hard to do, because that's so much the basis of the eating disorder, is this is something I can control.
Right. And I remember I still had this fantasy that I would get there and I could somehow manipulate the system to, like, lose weight. And I remember getting there and them sort of telling me, you know, you're going to be given a meal plan. You're going to be expected to finish everything on your plate. Just, again, like, the terror just...
And so you think, well, I'll go in the bathroom and I'll throw it up and then I'll be okay. And they don't let you do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are ways to get away with things. I think that, you know, treatment worked for me because, you know, in spite of momentary and, you know, I did have resistance to it and that came and went, but I think it worked for me because I was ready for it to work. I think, you can go to treatment and resist it, and you can find ways to purge, but I'm so, so, so grateful that for, you know, whatever reason, I was ready.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do today to maintain your recovery? Because you're around people in recovery all the time. That can be a drain or that can be a help. So how do you maintain your own recovery?
I do a lot of things. I often say to people that I think self-care is sort of at the basis of my recovery today, and which means just like continually nourishing myself in the ways I didn't before. So this means some like obvious things like I go to meetings and I go to a nutritionist and I have a meal plan and I check in with people around those things. In a more like general way, I think just relationships or what staying connected in healthy relationships, like that right there is my best defense against relapse. And I believe that the 12 steps are really how I have learned how to do that.
That's great.
Taught me a lot about being close to people for the first time, really. Ever.
Okay. So if there's somebody listening who is scared to death, but they think they might want to do this, what would you say to them?
You know, I can only just offer my honest experience, which is that, you know, I never believed there was a wonderful life waiting for me. I had no concept of that, and for me that there was, you know, and I think that's true for other people. You know, I went from a place of total shame and self-hatred to where I am today, and today I have a life that's about so much more than my body and my weight and my food, and it can be immensely painful to be in my life, but it has its immense joys as well, and it'll never be as bad as it was because I'm never alone at this point, and that makes all the difference in the world, you know. That's what keeps me confident that recovery is where I want to be. Yeah, even when I'm struggling, I'm not alone. I'm really, really connected to people around me that love me and support me.
Well, thank you so much, Mel. I really appreciate you being brave and allowing me to interview you. So
thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Kim some more.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
To perform at your maximum potential, you need to have all aspects of your life working properly. On Mind, Brain, and Body, Dr. Michael John Kell will bring you honest, open discussions concerning your physical, mental, and financial health. If you're ready to find purpose and meaning in your life, tune in to Mind, Brain, and Body every Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific. Mind, Brain, and Body on Voice America Health and Wellness. Radio dedicated to your health, wealth, wisdom, and purpose.
Do you remember what life was like when you were young? Having the mobility and ability to play all day and then sleep through the night without needing coffee in the morning? For the majority of us, gone are those days. But they don't have to be. Transforming Health with Brad King will show you how you can awaken your youthful energy potential and live a disease-free life of abundant energy and vitality. Transforming Health is broadcast live every Wednesday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Do you know if kidney disease is affecting you? Are your kidneys healthy? You may have kidney disease and not even be aware of it. 26 million people have been affected by kidney disease. Teenagers today are being diagnosed with symptoms such as high blood pressure, diabetes, and obesity. These conditions can worsen kidney health and cause kidney disease. Be sure to tune in to Improve Your Kidney Health with your host, Dr. Rich Snyder, every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. The information you get on this program could help save your life.
You're listening to the Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. Today we're talking about eating disorders. If you want to find out more, you can go to www.timberlineknowles.com or call 1-877-706-5922. We just heard a wonderful interview with a person in recovery by the name of Mel. She told us some very personal things, which was hard to do, and we appreciate that. And I hope that those who are listening will share this with other people who need to hear it. But let's go back and talk with the medical director, Dr. Kim.
Hi.
Hi. So let's talk about the different kinds or different types of eating disorders.
Sure. So there are three main eating disorder diagnoses and then different subtypes within those three. The most common of any of the eating disorders is something called eating disorder not otherwise specified, or EDNOS. And this would include compulsive overeating, binge eating disorder, or people who have most of the criteria for anorexia or bulimia, but not who don't meet every single criteria necessary to make that as a formal diagnosis. So by far that number is the number of people with eating disorder not otherwise specified is much, much bigger than those with anorexia and bulimia. Those are also the least likely to ever receive treatment for their eating disorder.
And can they develop into full-blown anorexia, bulimia, or the combination?
They can. A lot of people over the course of their lifetime experience the A's, B's, and C's of eating disorders. So they may experience anorexia at one point, bulimia at another point, or compulsive overeating at another point in their lives.
Okay.
So there is a lot of overlap among the diagnoses.
Okay. And people can enter treatment at different stages along the journey depending on whether they reach a bottom or whether somebody intervenes. So can you talk about that process of hitting bottom?
Sure. So the hitting bottom process almost always requires, like we heard in Mel's story, a number of outside factors coming together to influence somebody to get help. Sometimes this is family members. Sometimes these are treatment professionals. Sometimes it's significant others. But at some point, the unhealthy coping mechanism usually stops working in the way that it once did for people. So, for instance, if somebody's a purging bulimic, at some point, no matter how much food they binge on and no matter how many times a day they purge, it's not working to give them the same high and to give them the same escape from their reality that it once gave them. And it's usually at that point where the fear of staying in the disease becomes greater than the fear of getting help, that somebody is actually moved to go to treatment and to talk to people about getting help.
Okay. And the different kinds of purging, people can do laxatives, they can do making themselves throw up, they can take, what's the liquid you drink to make yourself throw up?
Ipecac.
Yeah, they can do that. Some people are very self-trained to make themselves vomit without even sticking their finger down their throat.
Yeah, absolutely. Exercise bulimia is another one.
Okay.
We see a fair amount of women with co-occurring substance abuse who use stimulants or cocaine or crack to manage their weight.
Mm-hmm. And then that becomes a problem all in itself.
Correct. People who have diabetes, this is common more in adolescents with diabetes, type 1 diabetes, which requires insulin, can manipulate their insulin to essentially effectively purge calories.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, and that's a very medically dangerous one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that can be deadly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in fact, any of them can be deadly, which is a message that people need to know.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
There are women and men who die every day in this country of an eating disorder or medical complications related to an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was active in my practice and I had some people that were bulimic, and I said, you know, you can die, your esophagus can rupture. And they said, no.
Well, not me.
Yeah, right. And when some of them actually did go to inpatient treatment, they said, you know, I had no idea that you were telling me the truth. I thought you were lying to me. You know, like, why would I do that?
Right.
What's the benefit for me to do that? And
you were just trying to manipulate your patients, Dr. Melanie.
Right. Right. And unfortunately, I had one patient who had been to a treatment center. It wasn't a good match. She came home. We were waiting to get the authorization to get her into another treatment center, and she died of cardiac arrest that night.
Oh,
so
tragic.
It's, yes. And that changed the way that I did treatment with people, that I would not work with them unless they signed a release and saw a doctor and the doctor and I could consult regularly. I don't want that liability. I don't want the person to die.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really recommended for any therapist in an outpatient practice or in an outpatient setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is.
Working with somebody with an eating disorder.
Yeah. What do you think the average age is that somebody starts to develop an eating disorder? Because nowadays I think it's even younger than it has been in times past.
Yeah, it's the average age of onset is trending downward. And usually when you ask somebody, how old were you when your eating disorder started? Early on in treatment, they may say, you know, 13 or 14 or 15, sometime in adolescence. But when you really work on peeling back the layers of denial, mm-hmm. they start talking about, I had body image problems when I was a five-year-old, or I thought I was fat when I was, you know, four, very, very, very young ages. And that's the point at which we need to be educating, doing preventative measures, and intervening, not at the point where somebody's binging and purging on a regular basis or starving themselves on a regular basis. But a lot of people will say adolescence as the time of onset for their disorder. We have we've also seen a trend recently of women in middle age or older women presenting for eating disorder treatment for the first time.
And is it a new development in their life that they have this eating disorder, or is it just now they're getting treatment for it?
It's usually the latter. And many of the women who say it's new, again, will describe subclinical eating disorder symptoms and severe disordered eating when they were adolescents or younger women. And then they have a life stressor, which really pushes them over the edge, and they, you know, develop the full-blown disorder.
Mm-hmm. And I've watched some people that have had these lap band surgeries and for many of them, I wonder, you know, did they rule out eating disorders before they had the surgery?
They need to be. We see quite a few women at TK who've had lap band and are now anorexic or are now alcoholic. You know, it's the emotional and spiritual underpinnings of whatever the addictive behavior is that is not addressed by a lap band surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So they may switch addictions to alcoholism, for instance.
Right. Do you believe professionally that the eating disorder is a brain disease, or do you think it's a combination of family issue that the symptoms come out in eating disorders? What's your thought about it?
I think it's both. One of the things we say a lot in the field is genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger. You know, I don't think every person, just like not everybody, just like alcohol doesn't do it for every person. You know, that reward center in the brain is like a fingerprint. So for one person, it might be turned on and fired up with shopping. For another person, it might be gambling. You know, I've had zero interest in gambling. I don't like gambling. It doesn't do anything for me. Purging, on the other hand, was like amazing for me. So I think that's, part of that is due to, specific receptors and a specific wiring in my brain's reward center. If it's somebody who, doesn't get that response from purging, they're not going to develop bulimia. So I think it's a combination of, what works to set off your brain neurochemistry and the underlying genetics and physical aspects. You know, there's the physical aspect of the body that responds in a certain way to certain substances or certain events.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty unique to the individual.
Mm-hmm. Is there an endorphin rush when somebody purges? Is that why they get that euphoric feeling?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And that's different. Not everybody gets that. So everybody's brain chemistry is different. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And when, you know, when bulimics stop purging and come to treatment, or come to treatment and then stop purging, they absolutely go through a withdrawal period that, is similar to a mild form of withdrawal from, opiates.
Yeah, and they're amazed when they are told that their weight actually, when they eat regular meals, is becoming, you know, it's not a high number. They think, oh, I'm going to become so obese, but it's not. And they're shocked.
Yeah, and for people with bulimia who binge and purge regularly, they actually, once they're stabilized on a sober meal plan, actually consume less food per week than they were when they were binging and purging.
So if people come to your treatment center, you use an integrative approach. What is that?
So we approach all of our residents in a holistic way. We address, you know, the physical, the spiritual, the emotional aspects of the illnesses. And we also don't pigeonhole people and identify them by their disease. I would say probably 95 to 98% of the women who come here have at least one co-occurring disorder. And
that means something else going on besides just the eating disorder, right?
Right. You know, these things typically don't happen in a vacuum. And for instance, if somebody comes in with alcoholism and bulimia, historically that person would be sent to a treatment center that deals with substance abuse to take care of her alcoholism, and then maybe she would be eligible to go to an eating disorder treatment center that doesn't usually take addicts who are active in their disease.
Mm-hmm.
So part of holistic means, you know, you treat the whole disease package and you address the underlying issues underneath both the eating disorder and the substance abuse at the same time using a similar treatment model.
Okay.
And here we use our clinical foundation is rooted in a blend of something called dialectical behavior therapy and 12-step facilitation.
Okay.
So for all comers.
What we'll do when, because you're coming back on January 12th and again in February, we can cover some more of these particular different directions that we approached today but didn't get to cover totally.
So. Wonderful.
So this has been very informative for me. I learned some things, and I hope you did too from the person in recovery.
Yes.
And I hope that when you come back next month, we will have had some listeners give us some ideas of questions they may have that they want answered. How about that?
That sounds fabulous.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And now, listeners,
welcome.
Thank you. And now, listeners, it's time for us to wrap up today's show. We learned about eating disorders, how they can affect males and females, and that it can be fatal if you don't get help. If you're somebody who's obsessed with your weight and you can't control either binging and purging or starving yourself, please consider treatment. Go to www.timberlineknowles.com or call 1-877-706-5922. Next week, we're going to be talking to Metagenics, a company that makes products based on the science of neutral genomics. Please peruse my website for resources that might be helpful to you, and be sure to tell other people about my show. Remember, you can download it to your phone. You can get it to iTunes. Remember, to help yourself, help someone else. Until next week, goodbye for now.
Thank you so much for joining us this week for the Dr. Melanie Show. Please join your host, Dr. Melanie Barton, again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. We'll see you next week for another great program.